This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, Governor J.B. Pritzker laid out new guidelines for how the state will monitor COVID-19 and make decisions if more restrictions need to be put in place. We'll hear what he had to say. Also, could the state be doing more to help some prisoners who remain locked up even after completing their sentences? And as we get closer to the start of school, it's uncertain if school sports will take place.
I really thought, come fall, we're going to have all those fall sports. And now, I don't think we are. I hate to be negative about it, and I hope I'm wrong. I really do.
A decision is expected soon. We'll talk about that and more this hour on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, Governor J.B. Pritzker lays out new guidance for the state when it comes to dealing with COVID-19. And later, international college students won a victory this week, but a lot of problems for those students remain. We'll take a look. That's ahead this hour. Schools are still trying to figure out how to get kids back in classrooms this fall, but along with academics come extracurricular activities like sports, and that's tricky in a pandemic. The Illinois High School Association this month reversed itself, prohibiting scrimmages and physical contact just days after lifting some restrictions. That's left athletes, coaches, and parents wondering about the upcoming sports seasons. We talk with Craig Anderson, executive director of the IHSA, which governs high school sports in the state, and he told us why the latest changes were made.
And I think there's two parts to that. So we had a situation at Lake Park High School where a number of students were tested positive. And when the governor's office released this information, they indicated that was a part of it, that there were some positive tests among students there. And in the age group, they were starting to see some increases. And so that was part of the reason. But additionally, the new changes brought our guidelines more in line with the Illinois State Board of Education's return to learn guidelines as it related to physical education and extracurriculars for when students return in the fall. So this brought our organization along with the Illinois State Board of Education's guidance for schools much more into alignment.
So Craig, how has this been received from both coaches as well as players, even parents? What have you heard so far?
It's been a mix. Many of our coaches and our administrators are just trying to fully understand the new limits, so they're asking a lot of questions, and rightfully so. You know, we thought when we referred to resuming summer contact days, and they understood that, but when we made these little restrictions, then, you know, they're really trying to discover what could or should they or shouldn't they do with these new restrictions in place. So that was a lot of what we were receiving from school administrators and some coaches. And then we also had some coaches that were a little disappointed. They just didn't seem this sort of extreme action should take place when the governor's office at least was only referencing one school where you would say there was possibly a significant number of positive tests. You know, why should every other school within the state, you know, top to bottom, have to reduce their limits? Couldn't it be a school by school? If the school had positive cases and they had to shut down their activities, fine, but those that weren't, couldn't they continue? And so we heard from coaches about that. And then from the parents, I've heard a few that praised us for making the changes because they thought it brought more safety precautions in place. But others, and with a couple of coaches too, this creates some concern about whether or not we'll be able to start in the fall, because the elimination of physical contact activities, if that's going to be in place as we get to August, where we would be beginning fall sports, that now there's a concern of, can we start fall sports? And so should we start to look at alternative plans if these restrictions are going to remain in place?
One of those alternative plans I have seen brought up earlier was the possibility of even flipping spring and fall sports, that You know, so football, for example, which it's very hard to distance and play football, and volleyball and some others like that, soccer, it would be that those would flip to the spring and maybe move some of the spring sports to the fall. But that seems like that would be awful hard to do on pretty short notice as well. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so it's part of the conversation. While where I sit, I really think it's kind of a last resort option, but it doesn't mean that it's not an option. We're looking at a number of things to consider, especially if in fact a number of our fall sports like soccer, volleyball, football couldn't go on in the fall. What are some other possibilities for how and if those could be played during the school year? But we do have some fall sports that I believe could go on under these restrictions. I mentioned golf and girls tennis is a fall sport, as well as girls swimming. The flipping seasons has a little bit of concern by our membership that if we would flip spring and fall sports, that, you know, and then we end up with a spike that the spring sports, if they're unable to go in the fall, now we've essentially eliminated them in back-to-back school years this past spring, and now they got flipped to the fall. And so my personal opinion is if whatever sport we might put in the fall gets eliminated because of a spike or some guidance that's offered down to us that we need to discontinue any activities that we're conducting, that we'd likely look then to a modified calendar, really reducing the season lengths, depending on, even if a season might only last 2 months as an example, that's an option that we should then consider versus having a particular sports season completely canceled.
Now, I know there'll be people who hear this and they'll say, you know, it's enough of a challenge to try to bring these kids back into the classroom and that maybe sports should take a back seat. Maybe they don't play this coming year. Your response to that?
Of course, there's a number of thoughts related to that. And all of this, you know, we're cautious of the safety of our students. You know, obviously, being and overseeing the Activities Association, I find a lot of value in high school sports and activity participation. And I think it's an important building block for students to have access to help shape their lives. You know, I love the fact that we're education-based and we fall right in line with and work cooperatively with our member schools for obvious reasons. So I guess I would side with the fact that, you know, I think students benefit from activity participation when they're doing it along with their education. So at the end of the day, if we determine that, you know, it's simply not safe for our students to, you know, participate in activities, then we will have to take a step back. There's no question. But I really think that without activities, many of our students will lose the incentive to push forward and continue on and be challenged in the classroom if they, you know, they know these opportunities that they value with activity participation are not going to be there.
Where do things lie as far as we head toward the upcoming school year? Is there a date that you're looking at where, you know, a decision has to be made? Or, I mean, does it have to be this month, very early August? Where, you know, what's the cutoff there for making this final call?
Yeah, well, I think we're approaching that. So I said early on, you know, when this question came up, you know, what's your timeline, that sometime between mid to late July, we really need to inform our member schools as to what they could anticipate in the fall. And so that continues to be my objective. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to convene our board of directors for a meeting the week of July 20th, so that's next week, to have some really frank discussion about where we're at, what the limits are currently, what the limits look like they're going to be for us in the fall, and then to make some decisions and get that communicated back to our membership so they can make appropriate plans. Because we couldn't wait too far into August. You know, practices are scheduled to start August 10th, even though potentially practices could be delayed. But even that, I think we need to let our membership know so they can make appropriate plans. So I anticipate before the end of July, those decisions will be made.
That's Craig Anderson, Executive Director of the Illinois High School Association. The IHSA is not commenting on a lawsuit that was filed this week. Attorney Thomas DeVore filed the suit in Montgomery County on behalf of his daughters, one a volleyball player, another a cheerleader, in the Hillsboro School District. DeVore says the state legislature, not the IHSA, should make the call when it comes to how or if sports can be played during the pandemic.
So all of this stuff that everybody's trying to do, why, it may be noble. We got to ask ourselves, does the law allow us to do that? Do we get to restrict freedoms? I mean, if they think worrying about a teenage kid getting sick, which is absolutely important, don't get me wrong, who's thinking about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parents that are telling me the emotional damage that's being happening to their children because they're going to be prohibited from doing these types of things? Does anybody consider that? My daughter understands the risks. She talks to me all the time. She doesn't want to help make anybody get sick. But if she's going to be prohibited from playing a sport because there's a chance she might get sick, she's willing to take that chance, right? She's willing to take that chance. She doesn't want anybody to get sick. She's a great kid. They're like all these teenage kids. I've got kids sending me messages crying because they think they're going to lose out. Who's quantifying the emotional damage that's happening to these kids because of that? I don't think anybody is.
That's Attorney Thomas DeVore. He filed suit against the IHSA over the rules outlined in its return to play plan. DeVore has also gone to court over Governor J.B. Pritzker's stay-at-home rules, and he's representing a parent in the Quincy School District who is suing over safety rules regarding students having to wear masks and have temperature checks when schools resume this fall. So much uncertainty regarding fall sports, and Ryan Mahan now joins us to discuss it further. He's a sports writer for the State Journal Register in Springfield. I don't know what you're hearing from players and coaches. I'm guessing they just want some direction, though.
Yeah, and, you know, with less than a month before the fall sports practices begin, I think, you know, that's the second Monday of August. We're less than a month from there, and we don't have any clear indication if that's going to be allowed. And so I was really confident earlier this summer that we would have a fall sports season, call it Pollyannish or whatever. But I really thought come fall, we're going to have a football season. We're going to have volleyball season. We're going to have all those fall sports. And now I don't think we are. I hate to be negative about it. And I hope I'm wrong. I really do. I've come to the realization that I'm not so sure anymore.
For those that don't follow high school sports that closely, are players behind where they normally would be as far as training or skill development that might be taking place in the summer?
I'm sure they are. I haven't talked to any players about that, but I'm sure that they've been doing some stuff on their own. I did a story on a runner, and you know, he said, you know, fortunately, you know, like cross country is one of those sports where he can just get out and run, but when you're not running with your team, even, you know, those guys are pushing you to do better, even in your workouts and just running around town. Those guys are pushing you. And if you don't have that, you know, you think of a cross country runner, you know, they can always just get out and run across town in a park or on a trail or something. And even they say, you know, not being able to practice together in groups hurts their cause. So if it hurts a cross country runner, you can only imagine how much not getting together and playing basketball or football or volleyball or soccer affects players on those teams, too.
Earlier, I talked with Craig Anderson of the IHSA about the fact that, again, here we are talking about sports, extracurricular activities, when there's still a lot of concern about even getting kids back into classrooms to do academics. But he mentioned, you know, that for sports is very important for a lot of these students. And something I think people may not understand, I'd like maybe to get your comments on this as well, is that in some towns, maybe some more than others, local sports is a pretty big deal. It's part of the fabric of the community. And that is lost if there's no sports season.
Take Pleasant Plains, for instance. You know, every season they've got teams that are capable of making deep postseason runs. And there's a lot of community support for the Pleasant Plains Cardinals high school sports teams in that town, or in Riverton, you know, those people that are fans of the Riverton Hawks, they love their teams, and they love their team, whether their football team goes 3-6 or 6-3 or even better. And it's a huge part of a town. And that's when you're looking at merging schools or closing schools, and, you know, it hurts the town's identity because You know, some towns only have claim to a zip code and a high school mascot. And when that's gone, it's hard on the entire community, whether they have a kid in the school or not.
Well, I got to ask you before I let you go, what has it been like for a sports reporter like yourself when the games, you know, pros, college, also local schools, all of those having been canceled, what have you been doing with all of that downtime?
That's the one nice thing about having a small staff is there's not a lot of just sitting around. You know, Bill and I continue to edit what goes in the next day's paper, plan what goes in the next day's paper. We're still writing some stories. We're trying to find the interesting offbeat stories to tell that maybe we don't have time to tell when we're inundated by high school and college sports. For instance, just a couple weeks into the whole lockdown, I was able to do a story on the NHRA drag racer from Springfield, Tim Wilkerson. And it was the first time I'd ever had an interview with him before. And he was very gracious and welcoming and warm. He brought me to his shop and, you know, had me look around. We had a photographer go and, you know, socially distanced, of course. But, you know, it was a story that I was able to tell. I was able to tell a story about, you know, a cross-country runner in the summer, you know, trying to get his perspective on where things are. And I've got a couple of things that I've long playing with, like FOIA requests and stuff, that I wouldn't have had time to dive deep into if we were constantly busy with sports. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want sports back. I definitely want to go cover. I would do anything to go cover a Springfield Sliders game right now, or a small school track meet out in the middle of nowhere, or just anything. Like I'm itching to do that. That's what I do. That's what I got into this for. I mean, I've always thought of myself as a journalist who just writes about sports, but sports is in my blood. It's too hard to just not be out covering games and out talking to athletes as soon as they get done with, you know, scoring the game winning touchdown, or talking to a coach who just won his 300th win or something like that. You know, it's just seeing that kind of stuff is really the main driver of what I do.
Ryan Mahan covers sports for the State Journal Register in Springfield. He looks forward to covering more of it when the games resume, whenever that happens. We're glad you're with us on Statewide. We'll hear what Governor J.B. Pritzker had to say about a new plan to prevent a resurgence of COVID-19. That's next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Governor J.B. Pritzker this week laid out some new guidance for the state when it comes to controlling COVID-19. That includes dividing the state into smaller regions. It also goes on to show how the State Department of Public Health will determine when an area needs to shut down or changes need to be made to slow the spread. Here's a few minutes of what the governor had to say.
First, opening up our economy does not have to come with a spike in cases. Other countries have done it successfully while reducing cases and infection rates. But that requires vigilance on the part of all of us. It's imperative that individuals, families, workers, and businesses follow the recommendations of doctors and epidemiologists, that we act quickly if we see any outbreaks and upticks, signs that could lead to a surge of coronavirus infections. Our guiding principle remains the same as it has been from the very beginning, keeping people safe and healthy. The virus is unforgiving, as we have seen in states in the South and the West. So it's important when we see trends in our data that indicate a potential problem in any region of Illinois, that we need to start tightening mitigations in that region before it's too late. The epidemiologists and professionals at IDPH have determined that we need to take action in a region if we see a sustained rise in the positivity rate, along with either a sustained increase in COVID-19 hospital admissions or a reduction in hospital surge capacities. A sustained rise in the positivity rate is defined as an increase in the 7-day rolling average for 7 days out of a 10-day period. In addition, if any region hits 3 consecutive days of an 8% average positivity rate, that will require action, period. These metrics are clear. Staying under these metrics will allow us to continue in phase four without having to take significant mitigation steps. At the end of the day, job one is to keep you and all the people that you love safe. We're also today changing the boundaries and the number of health regions in Illinois. Unlike when we first introduced the Restore Illinois plan at the beginning of May, our growth in testing and tracing has given us a much more surgical ability to manage outbreaks and address problems locally. So going forward, we have the ability now to monitor and measure progress in 11 separate regions, based largely on our 11 hospital emergency medical services regions, referred to as EMS regions, that have traditionally guided IDPH in its statewide public health work. For ease of management of this coronavirus pandemic, we've redrawn some EMS regions, but left most of the regions as they were. For example, the city of Chicago will be in a region of its own, as will suburban Cook County. As for the collar counties, we've shifted regions based on geographic contiguity. For example, Kendall and Grundy counties will now be in a region that is not part of the collar counties. Remember that the goal of the regional lines is in large part to make sure that there is healthcare availability. This plan lays out an array of mitigation strategies that can be applied if a region breaches the resurgence metrics. These mitigations cover categories like bars and restaurants, meetings, social events, religious gatherings, and organized group recreational activities like adult and youth sports. In each category, we have three tiers of mitigations, allowing us to move carefully but deliberately, depending upon the severity of the situation, to control the spread of the virus while continuing to allow a region to be open to the greatest extent possible. Unfortunately, outbreaks are taking place consistently and in every region of the state. In just the last few weeks, we've had outbreaks tied to athletic camps, July 4th parties, and churches. As I said yesterday, bars remain another concerning source of rising positivity rates in various regions. As we've seen concerning trends, it's been important to me to sound the alarm with local officials who can take immediate targeted steps before we intervene at the state level. I'm also deeply troubled by outbreaks that we're seeing all around the state tied to activities like youth sports, like in Lake Zurich, where dozens of students and parents have tested positive in a related outbreak, and in Knox County, where a teen softball league is also experiencing an outbreak. Remember, the degree to which we can reduce risk and restore aspects of our daily lives is still unfolding. We're continually evaluating what works and what doesn't work. Let me reiterate what I've said from day one. IDPH and I are ready to take immediate action there and elsewhere if trends in the data require it. Looking ahead, I know that many people have concerns about in-person learning in schools. As a parent, I share those worries. Every school district is different. Different building sizes, different flows of students across campuses, different numbers of students and teachers per square foot. One size doesn't fit all. So the Illinois State Board of Education recently released guidelines for how districts can return to in-person learning. There's room for adaptation to local circumstances in the guidance, but there are some requirements that must be adhered to. For example, face coverings, distancing, and classroom capacity requirements. In every decision relating to this viral threat, schools must focus on giving our children the best education possible while offering the greatest consideration to their health and the health of their families and all of those who work in our schools. Hybrid schedules and remote learning are likely to be a part of that solution. Parents should be fully engaged in understanding what policies each district is moving toward and should be fully included in discussions of how to adapt to local and individual needs. But to be very clear here, any district that intends to disregard this guidance is gambling with the lives of our children, teachers, and families. Districts that don't live up to public health guidelines and standards and don't make a genuine attempt to protect their communities from this virus could be held liable in the courts by community members who are ill affected. I'm a father. I understand that parents are worried sick about having to choose between seeing their kids miss even more in-person schooling at critical ages and the very real threat of this virus. Good people with good intentions can disagree on how and when kids should go back to school. But let me be clear, I wouldn't let my own children return to a school where masks are not mandatory, and serious effort hasn't been made to keep students distanced during the day. This should not be controversial. Remember, the degree to which communities can mitigate risk and restore more normalcy to daily life in the months ahead is, to a large extent, in the hands of the people of our state. Taking precautions, following the mitigations recommended by doctors and epidemiological experts, like wearing masks in public places and keeping some physical distance, are necessary for us to keep all Illinoisans safe and healthy.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. He was speaking this week to reporters as he announced changes to the state's guidance regarding COVID-19, including a warning to school districts. You can also read more about the governor's plan, including the 11 different regions that he referenced. We have a link at statewideshow.com. The governor says he's doing all he can to slow the spread of the coronavirus disease in state prisons. He stopped new admissions into the system, and he's tried to speed up some releases. But there are hundreds of people who have completed their sentences, yet they remain behind bars, vulnerable to COVID-19. For WBEZ, Jessica Popovac filed this report.
Marcus Barnes was convicted of a horrible crime, criminal sexual assault. He was sentenced and served his time, 10 years. As his release date got closer, getting out and seeing his family was all he could think about.
My father and my cousin, my daughter, they're like, what you want to eat? Just get ready. We're going to pick you up.
Barnes was set to move into an apartment owned by his uncle in Chicago's Lawndale neighborhood. But turns out, it was only a block away from a home daycare, something that would be a violation of his parole because of the nature of his conviction. So, because of that, on December 17th, 2018, the day he thought he'd be walking out of prison, he was told he wouldn't be going anywhere.
I kind of braced because my body just couldn't move for a second.
His family started making alternate plans. His cousin, Delshay McDaniel, said he could live with her.
My address was declined because I actually have an infant.
So the family found different options, but those were also rejected.
One of them was because there was someone there that was disabled. One was denied because there was no phone line, which we could have just put one in, but they just denied it.
McDaniel says the family found 11 different homes for her cousin. Every plan was rejected. So Barnes just stayed in prison, even though he'd finished his time. The Illinois Department of Corrections says there are about 1,200 people who are held beyond the end of their sentences every year. And not just for a few weeks. Some have been there an extra 7 or 8 years. Many of them are people who have to register as sex offenders, like Barnes, and so can't live within 500 feet of a school or park or any number of other restrictions. IDOC says it's just trying to keep everyone safe and follow the law. That's why Republican Representative Margo McDermid says Illinois law needs to change. She was working on legislation to ease Illinois' housing restrictions and get some of these people out before COVID. Now, she says, it's even more urgent.
If folks are coming out, then here's a group that should be out already. And so why don't we see what we can do about that?
When Governor Pritzker announced plans in March to reduce Illinois' prison population, McDermid says she reached out to Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton's team.
Because, you know, social justice and equity are her thing, right? And that didn't go anywhere.
So she went up the ladder to the governor's office.
And that didn't go anywhere. the state's going to have to do something about these people because they can't be in prison forever. I don't know.
Pritzker and Stratton did not respond to questions about their conversations with McDermott or their positions on the issue. A coalition of about 40 advocacy groups led by the Chicago 400 Alliance is organizing to push the governor on it. In the meantime, civil rights attorney Adele Nicholas has taken the matter to the courts.
Many of these people have safe and welcoming housing to go to outside of IDOC, but the Illinois laws are so restrictive that IDOC won't let these people go home, even though they're done with their sentences and are entitled to be released.
She's argued that keeping people incarcerated past their out dates, especially during a pandemic, amounts to cruel and unusual punishment.
I get calls from worried spouses and mothers and fathers and siblings every day.
Nicholas has won some cases, including Marcus Barnes's. He had been 16 months past his release date as COVID hit Illinois and the prisons.
Trying to act like, you know, it's okay, but I was a little terrified a little bit. You know?
And now that he's out?
And I was thanking God for, you know, me getting another opportunity to come out and put my life together, get my daughter's life, and just make some of myself.
In addition to Barnes, Nicholas has won the release of another 32 prisoners. But she says using such a piecemeal legal approach will leave hundreds of people who have served their time at heightened risk of contracting coronavirus while they wait for relief. Jessica Popovac, WBEZ News.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is meant to provide financial assistance to families struggling to afford food. Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, those monthly payments, formerly known as food stamps, have been boosted to account for lost jobs and financial insecurity, and many are wondering whether that will continue. To learn more about how the program works and find out what SNAP recipients can expect going forward, reporter Dana Cronin spoke with Leslie Cully. She oversees the SNAP program in Illinois.
First off, I want to ask you the question that I know is on a lot of people's minds, which is, will there be additional SNAP benefits this month in July?
We have been approved to issue those emergency allotments or those maximum allotments for July. That's triggered by the fact that the state still, the governor has issued an emergency declaration that extends into July. Most of our regular allotments, our regular SNAP allotments, go out staggered between the 1st and the 20th of the month. So we're staggering the emergency allotments between the 20th and the 30th, just so the stores and the grocery stores can keep fresh food and produce on their shelves. Try to stagger the benefits out throughout the month.
I imagine that's a relief for a lot of listeners to hear. But I also wonder, you know, what the plan is for next month, August, and then the months going forward.
FNS has not indicated that the emergency allotments will stop. Again, right now, the only trigger is if the state still has an emergency declaration in place. So if the governor extends Illinois' emergency declaration into August, we will then submit a revised plan to FNS for approval to issue those emergency allotments for August also.
And as you mentioned, the decision of whether or not to issue maximum SNAP benefits in a given month lies with FNS, the Food and Nutrition Service. How do you communicate with them about that?
We have a great relationship with our Midwest regional office, and they are our liaison between the Midwest states and national office. You know, each region of the country has a regional staff that they work with. So we're meeting with them weekly throughout this pandemic. They've been a wonderful partner in this. So at this point, our plan has already been approved for these emergency allotments. We just need to submit to them via email a request to extend them into the next month, and they're usually very responsive.
Illinois Newsroom has heard from some regular SNAP recipients that they haven't been receiving those maximum benefits. I wonder if you have any idea why that may be, whether you've been hearing similar stories.
We've heard from a few, and we've got a very close relationship with our core advocacy community. So they sent us a few examples of folks that they've heard from who did not receive these supplements. And in every specific case we looked at, it was because the family had already received the maximum amount. So what these emergency allotments do is allow a family or an individual who was not already receiving the maximum for their household side. It supplemented them up to the maximum amount. But if a household was already receiving the maximum amount, then there is no, they're not eligible for any type of a supplement.
That's Dana Cronin speaking with Leslie Cully, who oversees the SNAP program for the Illinois Department of Human Services. To stay up to date on SNAP benefits and whether or not they'll be maxed out, Cully says she recommends visiting the Department of Human Services Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn pages. There is more of Statewide ahead. Thanks for tuning in to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, thousands of farm workers have contracted COVID-19 in more than a dozen states. Some say the lack of a coordinated federal response is putting workers at risk. We'll hear how medical clinics are stepping up to get farm workers tested. That story's on the way. Well, in Springfield, an alderman, Joe McMiniman, apologized this week for comments that he made at a recent city council meeting. The comments sparked a wider conversation about race and unconscious bias, and Mary Hansen talked with a diversity expert.
Rachel Yoakum says at first when she heard what McMiniman had said at last week's meeting, she was disappointed.
But not even just disappointment for that moment, but to think about how long he's been in that position of power and how many decisions he's possibly made through that lens of bias.
Yoakum is a diversity and inclusion manager for a Bloomington-based corporation and runs her own consulting firm in Springfield. But before we hear more from her, here's the exchange she's referring to between McMiniman and Alderwoman Doris Turner.
Yeah, we want to get as much broad representation as possible, but it can be difficult to achieve that. Let's face it, yes, some neighborhoods have just a quantity of very well-educated...
Oh my God, you didn't say that.
Yeah, I did say it, because some of our boards and commissions, they call for expertise in certain areas.
Oh my goodness.
Or some...
Yoakum says what concerns her about the statement is that it's false, and those falsehoods can create harmful narratives about whole groups of people.
In order to make a comment that is so broad about the lack of education of an entire community is almost a ridiculous thought, right? I mean, even when we get into comments of social media where folks are saying they need to pull up their pants, right? They need to go get a job. You know, you can look at your close friends and family that are in the brown and black community, and they're all working. They don't need to pull up their pants. So why is that our narrative? Why is that the story that we tell ourselves? Even if there's a small group of folks that fit into that narrative, we can't make that for an entire group of people. And so that creates bias, and we all have bias.
On Tuesday, McMiniman again apologized for his words to the council and to residents whom he offended. He told NPR earlier,
they thought it was a racial comment, and for me, it was a neighborhood geographic comment. I never spoke of north, south, east, or west, and I never mentioned a ward number. And a lot of people put words in my mouth, and that's unfortunate.
McMiniman says he thinks his comments should be interpreted in the context of the debate around Springfield's boards and commissions. City council members have argued for weeks about the makeup of the new Housing Policy Council and the lack of racial diversity as well as geographic representation of all the city's appointees. McMiniman says he supports diversity on the city's commission and praised the mayor for appointing a majority of African-American members to the new Housing Policy Council. Still, Yoakum says the concerns around his comments run deeper.
Are you not creating businesses and opportunities and bringing up discussions around putting things on certain areas of Springfield because you think less educated people are in those communities?
McMiniman defended his record and says he doesn't think there's been bias in the votes he's cast in his 9 years on the council. For Yoakum, she says she hears similar bias in the work she does with leaders of Springfield's businesses and nonprofits. She says they're harder to pinpoint than the blatantly racist comments you might see on Facebook.
So when you hear executives make comments like, I want to hire the most qualified person, what you're not hearing in that statement is that they don't think that women, brown or black people are qualified. That's a problem. That is impacting who's getting jobs in this community. That's impacting who, what type of pay you're making. Are they only hiring those folks for lower level positions? So that mindset at the top and our executive leaders is a problem.
Yoakum says part of the solution is to get more involved in local nonprofits and politics, to vote, watch city council and school board meetings, and join those nonprofit boards and city commissions where decisions are made. She also has this advice for McMiniman and others.
He can't just stay in his block where he knows people in his neighborhood because that's the picture he sees. So that's where he thinks education is. That's where he thinks power and privilege and all those things. And he needs to see more.
Tuesday night, McMiniman encouraged residents from all neighborhoods to apply to serve on the city's commissions. I'm Mary Hansen.
The U.S. relies on more than 2 million seasonal farm workers to cultivate and harvest crops. In the Midwest, workers are now heading out into the fields amid concerns about COVID-19 outbreaks. For Side Effects Public Media, Christine Herman reports on efforts to keep them safe.
Maricel Mendoza grew up in a family that traveled from Texas to Illinois every year for her parents' jobs as contractors with a large seed company.
My parents' siblings were migrants. My grandparents were migrants. So it was just something that was the norm for me.
As a teen, she spent several summers out in the fields herself, detasseling corn. That meant yanking off the pollen-producing top portion of plants to promote crossbreeding with nearby varieties, creating hybrid seed corn.
It's long days. You know, your bus is leaving before the sun comes up. You're working in the rain, you're working in mud, you're working with bugs.
Today, Mendoza directs a small clinic in central Illinois that provides medical services to the hundreds of farm workers that arrive here each summer and fall, mostly from southern U.S. states and Mexico. This year, the clinic is working with companies and health departments to test everyone for COVID-19. The goal is to clamp down on cases before they spread. Lately, they've been traveling the state, setting up outdoor mobile clinics under tents. Mendoza says she thought workers might be hesitant to get tested, since a positive result would mean missing out on work.
But, you know, every COVID testing site we've set up that I've been at, you've seen people willingly come and line up and wanting to get the test done. And, you know, they have questions and they're wearing their masks.
Mendoza's clinic is part of the Community Health Partnership of Illinois. It's one of many federally funded health clinics whose work is critical now, says Sylvia Partida.
When the pandemic first started and we were just beginning to hear about the impact on farm workers, we knew it was coming. You know, you just knew that it was going to get worse and worse and worse.
Partida is CEO of the National Center for Farm Worker Health, based in Texas. Many patients at the migrant clinics they support across the U.S. live below the federal poverty line and lack health insurance. The vast majority are Hispanic or Latino, populations that have been disproportionately hurt by COVID-19. She says no one is systematically tracking COVID-19 cases among farm workers, but her organization has compiled reports showing at least 3,000 workers across 15 states have tested positive, and several have died. Partida worries that social distancing is difficult out in the fields and in the dorm-style housing and the buses that transport workers to and from field sites. She says the lack of a coordinated federal response is putting workers at risk.
Now we're in a situation where we don't want interruptions in our food supply. And so that means we're sacrificing individuals that are doing that work.
I have a lot of concerns about all of it.
Chicago-based attorney Miguel Keberline Gutierrez has spent years providing legal services to migrant workers in Illinois.
The system has absolutely historically been set up to exploit people. People continue to take jobs because for a lot of them, it's the only option they actually have.
At least one Midwest company says it's offering paid time off for those who need to isolate or quarantine. It's also encouraging testing and providing workers with masks. But Keberline Gutierrez worries about the lack of accountability and the inability of overburdened health departments to enforce state and federal guidelines. And Mendoza, with the Central Illinois Clinic, says it takes 5 days to get test results, which may allow COVID-19 to spread.
It's always a concern, you know, that we're not doing enough, we don't have enough resources, or what can we do to do better? We're constantly having that conversation.
So far, she's aware of at least one worker in Illinois who's tested positive. As detasseling season kicks off, she's just hoping more workers don't get sick. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
That story was produced in partnership with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. A report on housing affordability calls for more federal help for people facing pandemic-caused economic hardship. The U.S. House of Representatives approved a plan offering nearly $200 billion in aid and a federal moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. The executive order in Illinois banning action on evictions is set to expire at the end of this month. Assistance should be done on a targeted basis, according to Paul Arena with the Illinois Rental Property Owners Association.
I think the eviction moratorium is just misplaced. It's too broad and it affects too many other aspects of housing for that to be an effective approach.
The National Low Income Housing Coalition and Housing Action Illinois annual report says nowhere in the state can a full-time minimum wage worker afford a two-bedroom apartment at the fair market rate. Immigration and Customs Enforcement had announced international students must take some of their classes online. If not, they could be deported from the United States. But this week, the Trump administration rescinded that decision. For our Illinois Issues report, Peter Medlin reports on the uncertainty many international students continue to face during COVID-19.
When he first saw the news from ICE, Sina Tayebati thought it was all over. He might be getting deported back to Iran. He's a graduate student studying mechanical engineering at Northern Illinois University.
It was so terrifying for all of us, for me and for my family. We had spent a lot of money and we have invested a lot for me to be here.
Amin Rustai felt the same way. He was shocked. He's a grad student in the same department.
What would come to my, research year? If you believe it or not, I barely slept last night because of this news. It was really embarrassing.
They were told their classes would be online this fall, but with the sudden ICE announcement, departments are scrambling to convert courses to be partially in person. Ashik Rahman is from Bangladesh. He says his fellow computer science students were told to prepare for online classes.
I know many of them went back home. They can't really come back in right now because there are no flights or anything.
During the spring semester, NIU had about 800 international students, mostly in grad programs. Only 20% of them went home during the pandemic, according to the International Student and Scholar Services Office. Many couldn't go home due to travel restrictions, and others just couldn't find a plane ticket. Stephanie Brown, the director of the International Student Office, says Chinese students couldn't get tickets for less than $5,000. Iranian students like Amin and Sina didn't have much choice. They're on F-1 single-entry visas, and now they're scared that if they're deported, there's no way for them to get back and finish school. The University of Illinois joined other universities suing to end the restrictions, and the Trump administration has since rescinded the order. International students stuck in the U.S. during COVID-19 have faced a host of other issues, too. Some international students are struggling just to pay rents and groceries. They've had help from the university, mostly through a $500 emergency fund and some tuition reimbursement. There are students who say the university and international student office should be more responsive. Pia Nusatai is an undergrad student from Cambodia.
If I were to be honest, they haven't responded to me since I sent them an email months ago.
It's stressful to be stranded in a foreign country during a pandemic. Amin Rustai says some haven't seen their families in a long time.
I have to be here for 2 years without seeing my father, my family. It's a very sad story, but we have to overcome these hardships to get our degree here.
International students depend on their universities for much more than just education, work too. They have to work at their university. Many are graduate researchers and teaching assistants. Most grad assistant contracts ended in the spring, and jobs are sparse in the summer. Amin Rustai has a contract and has been working, but he says he still hasn't been paid. He was told his payment could be processed in mid-July, but he's not sure of it. In the meantime, students are dipping into already slim savings. And because of the sanctions on Iran, Amin's family can't even send him money. Sina Tayebati has no contract, but has still been working over 20 hours, handling meetings, and working on his thesis research.
I want to work on that, but at least we expect our advisors, or generally the university, to support us when we are working for the university without getting paid.
He's hoping to get a TA position to make money in the fall, but there's no guarantee. COVID-19 has also made life very difficult for international students who just graduated. Normally, they'll have 60 to 90 days to find a job, but with many being laid off or unable to find work, time is running out and their immigration status could be in jeopardy. Lisa Diedrich is the executive director of Network of Nations, a nonprofit assisting international students.
They have gone back to live with friends because that is their community. NIU is their community. Give them grace. The stress on them is huge.
Diedrich is calling on Illinois lawmakers to help extend that time called optional practical training. She says in a perfect world, they'd give students until the end of the year. Tayebati says the whole situation, especially the ICE deportation threat, is tragic for international students who can already feel isolated in the U.S. It's still uncertain how many new international students will make it to U.S. universities when they reopen next month. I'm Peter Medlin.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this program or past episodes, you can find them at statewideshow.com. Our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.